This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 12, 2003. From the studios of WBAI in New York City, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Pressure mounts on undecided Security Council members as the Pentagon threatens to bomb on the satellite uplink positions of independent journalists in Iraq. The Bush administration is shopping its welfare reform bill to the Senate Finance Committee today. And Dalma Banks will be executed tonight by the state of Texas. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Fearing civil unrest after their prime minister was assassinated today, Serbia's acting president has imposed a nationwide state of emergency. Jeremy Scahill has more from Belgrade.
Just hours after Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic was pronounced dead on arrival at the urgent care center in Belgrade, the Serbian government imposed a state of emergency. Special police units are patrolling the streets, stopping cars and pedestrians. All outbound flights from the city's international airport have been canceled. Shortly after noon Belgrade time, Djindjic was shot three times by unidentified gunmen, reportedly operating from a nearby building that was undergoing renovations. He sustained fatal injuries to his stomach and back. News reports here say that police have three men in custody, but it's unclear if they're suspects or witnesses. Zoran Djindjic was a man with many enemies. He almost single-handedly facilitated the unpopular extradition of Slobodan Milosevic to The Hague. His death is already creating a political crisis here, as his governing coalition operated more like a dictatorship than a democratic movement. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade.
The Turkish military fired shots over the heads of anti-war protesters at the docks where U.S. forces are unloading the necessities of war. Nicholas Birch reports from Istanbul.
There were sharp clashes between Turkish security forces and anti-war protesters today as a group of demonstrators tried to break into the Mediterranean port where U.S. ships are unloading military equipment for a Turkish front against Iraq. After tussling with baton-wielding policemen, around 200 protesters fled when soldiers began firing over their heads. Today's demonstrators were largely left-wingers, but with opinion polls showing well over 90% of Turks opposed to war, such protests are not a minority pastime. For the past week, U.S. convoys have been transporting logistical equipment to bases close to Turkey's border with Iraq. In the wake of the Turkish parliament's refusal to allow U.S. troops to begin deploying in Turkey, several senior ministers here have questioned the legality of such moves. But they are a clear sign Washington expects Turkey's lawmakers to bow to the inevitable and push a second deployment bill through parliament soon. Nicholas Birch in Istanbul for Free Speech Radio News.
The largest bloc of developing countries in the United Nations General Assembly is calling on its membership in the Security Council to vote no on a U.S.-backed war resolution. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The Malaysian government is appealing to six countries in the Security Council to reject the U.S. and British resolution authorizing war with Iraq. The six are members of the Non-Aligned Movement, which Malaysia currently chairs. Syria has announced its intention to vote against the resolution, but the remaining five countries, whose votes are contested by the pro- and anti-war camps, have so far refused to commit themselves publicly. Malaysia is asking them to honor an anti-war declaration approved at a NAM summit in its capital, Kuala Lumpur, in February. Speaking last night at the start of an open Security Council debate called at NAM's request, the Malaysian ambassador said the 116-member non-aligned movement believes the Iraq issue can be resolved peacefully through the UN. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Today's Guardian of London newspaper reports that Vice President Dick Cheney is still on the Halliburton dole. More from Pokey Anderson at KPFT in Houston.
Dick Cheney pulls in a salary of $186,000 as vice president. According to a report in today's Guardian, Cheney is receiving annual payments from Halliburton, deferred compensation of up to $1 million a year. A decade ago, during the Gulf War, then Secretary of Defense Cheney oversaw one of the largest privatization efforts in the history of the Pentagon. Cheney became CEO of Halliburton from 1995 to 2000. The Department of Defense has already given an unusual cost-plus award contract to Halliburton to build operating bases to support troops for the next 9 years of the anti-terrorism war. There is no upper limit on the contract. The vice president's office said it has nothing to do with the award of Pentagon contracts and said it would look into the details of the payments to Cheney from Halliburton. Halliburton would not comment on how large the payments are. From Houston, Texas, this is Pokey Anderson for Free Speech Radio News.
Harvard University students, teachers, and staffers staged a noon walkout today making a 2,000-person-strong statement against military action in Iraq. From Boston, Chuck Rosina reports.
The event was organized by the Harvard Initiative for Peace and Justice, amongst other groups. Jesse Salito, a Harvard student, was among those who addressed the rally. He said, "We refuse to be silent. We're here today to accuse the Bush administration of having power without compassion, of having might without morality." Many students pledged that business will not go on as usual if America goes to war. They vowed to walk out of classes at noon the day after an attack. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina, reporting from Harvard University.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the British government released what it called the plan to get its new UN resolution adopted by at least 9 of the 15 Security Council members. The plan involves Iraqi President Saddam Hussein declaring on television that he'll give up what the British government calls his, quote, hidden weapons of mass destruction, as one of the 6 conditions to avoid war, as well as allow Baghdad to allow scientists to be questioned abroad before a set deadline. This is yesterday 40 British MPs called on Tony Blair to resign. George Galloway, a Labour MP speaking to FSRN soon after leaving Parliament for the day, says there's a growing sentiment that Blair's days are numbered if he goes ahead with war.
The position of the axis of evil intent on the Security Council appears to be changing by the hour. From the ludicrous that Saddam Hussein appear on television, presumably wearing a red nose and a pair of donkey's ears, right across to the Spanish government saying in the last hour that they'd rather tear up their second resolution than risk its defeat, on the grounds that, fantastically enough, that if they press it to a vote and it loses, then any country which subsequently attacks Iraq will be doing so in open defiance of the United Nations. Well, quite so.
This is Defence Secretary Donald Rumsfeld today dismayed the British pro-war sector when he declared, quote, US and UK interests have diverged because Mr. Blair needs to go to the UN Security Council and Mr. Bush does not. Britain also sought to amend the resolution to lengthen their earlier ultimatum, perhaps to as late as March 24. And while the politicians continue to battle it out, the British people held their own forum. George Galloway again.
We had what's called a People's Parliament, just a few hundred yards from the official parliament. Both parliaments are talking shops in the sense that neither has any power over these events. But the difference is the People's Parliament spoke for Britain and the official parliament spoke for George W. Bush. Hundreds of thousands of British people have pledged themselves that if Britain starts the war, we will stop the country. And I believe the Blair regime will be in its last days if that occurs.
Meanwhile, pressure is mounting on Angola, Cameroon and Guinea, the 3 African nations on the Security Council that are still undecided on how they'll vote in the pending resolution authorising war. During the recent Afro-French summit held in France, there was agreement from the African nations with the French position on war. However, all 3 nations have been feeling increased pressure from the US to vote in its favour at the Security Council. Both President Bush and Vice President Cheney have called Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos of the last 24 hours to put on the heat. Prime Minister Blair has invited dos Santos to make his first ever official trip to Britain. Bill Fletcher of Trans Africa says that while the people of these African nations, and most likely the governments too, fall into the anti-war camp, what the US has to offer may be too great for the African nations to turn down.
Well, Guinea, the Cameroon, and Angola are all impoverished countries. At the same time, they are, particularly Cameroon and Angola, are very wealthy resource-wise. And what those 2 countries, Angola and Cameroon, have that the United States has its eyes set on is oil. Those countries badly need trade and assistance from the West. And part of the pressure that's certainly on them, if they do not bow to the will of the Bush administration, the question facing them is whether they will get the trade that they need, the trade and assistance.
In a public debate before the UN Security Council yesterday afternoon, South Africa's UN ambassador spoke to the rising sentiments in Africa against the war.
Millions of people around the world have openly rejected this war and believe, as we do, that this war is not necessary.
And in Australia, there's mounting public pressure against any Australian involvement in a war against Iraq. Today, President Bush spoke with Prime Minister John Howard, and they agreed that, quote, the matter of Iraq should come to a head quickly, and that Iraq clearly remains in breach of its obligations. The Australian Prime Minister will outline his case on Iraq tomorrow in a speech to the National Press Club. Yet to the outrage of many, Australian troops are already in the Middle East. Brigadier Murray McMahon spoke with the ABC's World Today in Qatar about their role.
Part of my job is to watch the American planning in considerable detail, identify what tasks we might do should the government choose to commit us. But I'm not about to lock us into any tasks or any commitment until I get the government go-ahead.
According to an internet news story yesterday, veteran BBC correspondent Kate Eady revealed on an Irish radio station that the Pentagon has threatened to bomb on the satellite uplink positions of independent journalists in Iraq. KPFK's Sonali Kohatka with Christopher Sprinkle reports.
In an interview on an Irish radio talk show, veteran BBC war correspondent Kate Eady said, quote, I was told by a senior officer in the Pentagon that if uplinks were detected by any planes, they'd be fired down on, even if they were journalists. Kate Eady clarified that the satellite uplinks would be targeted down, not fired upon.
Time and again, it has been pressed these days to the military that modern journalists are going to be using satellite uplinks, both for satellite telephones and also to send copy and photographs and also television pictures. And it has been argued back, and it is no secret, that these links, first of all, constitute a problem when used on the home side, in other words, amongst one's allies, because the argument is that they identify positions. And there is much talk about restricting the use of these, especially with embedded journalists. When I turn to the point of what about targeting about uplinks that come from places such as Baghdad, it was made perfectly clear that the military cannot distinguish between communications, which it was then said to me, could come from, for example, the Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard communicating with each other, and from journalists communicating to the outside world. And therefore, it is perfectly possible that these could be, quote, neutralized, and that at the end of them would be hostile people, and therefore they could be targeted down.
We spoke earlier today with Chief Diane Perry from the Department of Defense's Office of Public Affairs about the targeting of journalists in case of war. Her response was that the assertion was, quote, ridiculous. She went on to say that there is an inherent risk for journalists in wartime, that journalists could be fired upon accidentally because the military uses the enemy's satellite uplinks as targeting information. Quote, if they, the journalists, are independent, are not embedded, and our troops don't know where they are, they could be mistaken as enemy troops, end of quote. A Department of Defense document on embedding media during possible future operations or deployments in the U.S. Central Commands describes what the media can and can't do. The document states, quote, media coverage of any future operation will, to a large extent, shape public perception of the national security environment now and in the years ahead. To accomplish this, we will embed media with our units. These embedded media will live, work, and travel as part of the units with which they are embedded to facilitate maximum in-depth coverage of U.S. forces in combat and related operations. Our people in the field need to tell our story. Only commanders can ensure the media get to the story alongside the troops. BBC correspondent Kate Eady said the U.S. military and Pentagon is actually hostile to the free spread of information in the case of war.
Surprise and secrecy are a weapon of war, and it is a long tradition within the military across the world that they do not deliver the full story instantly. I'd have thought it highly unlikely that there was any desire, particularly regarding Mr. Dick Cheney's attitudes and spoken proven statements on this account, that they would wish to give a full and authoritative access. It will be limited, it will be censored, and it will be controlled. That is always the way. And it has to be recognized as such, and people would be fools if they thought it otherwise.
This report was co-produced by Christopher Sprinkle and Sonali Kolhatkar for Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles.
The Bush administration shopped its welfare reform bill to the Senate Finance Committee today. The package passed the House last month in a largely party-line vote. If it gets out of the Senate in its current form, it'll put strict limits on the amount of time most welfare recipients can spend in education and training programs. The bill's critics say it doesn't do enough to get people out of poverty permanently. Josh Chaffin reports from the Capitol.
The welfare reform bill the White House presented today would freeze the grants to states for temporary assistance to needy families, called TANF, at $16.6 billion over 5 years. Some $300 million a year of that money would go to experiments in promoting marriage. It would also extend a $50 million program promoting abstinence, which bans any discussion of contraception. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson.
His proposal builds a foundation for helping more families find jobs, achieve self-sufficiency, and become stronger and healthier.
The White House would like to increase the number of hours that welfare recipients have to work from 30 hours a week to 40 hours. They'd have to be in jobs for 24 of those hours, leaving 16 for school, job training, rehab, or parenting classes. Stephanie Robinson at the Center for Community Change.
They want to make people do some make work, you know, maybe community service or what have you, that doesn't go towards any better developing anyone, that doesn't go to bringing any more money into anyone's household. And what it really does in most instances is it causes people to spend more time away from their children and their families because they're traveling from the, you know, low-wage job that they have to sort of some sort of work fair that may be all the way across town.
Robinson is particularly concerned that the White House bill would continue to bar legal immigrants from welfare, disability, and Medicaid benefits for the first 5 years that they're in the country. As for child care, the president's package would provide $1 billion over 5 years, defeating proposals asking for as much as $11 billion. Advocates for the poor have long argued child care is a basic anti-poverty building block, as it allows people to go to work. Today, it was a Republican, West Virginia Senator John D. Rockefeller, complaining to Secretary Thompson about child care funding.
We're in terrible fiscal constraints, as all states are, and we don't have, and this, the child care money is not going to cut it. And quite frankly, if the child care money doesn't cut it, then the program isn't going to work.
Secretary Thompson asked the Senate Financial Committee to remember that the economy is in a downswing. The country is at war and could be going to war again soon. The president's defense budget for 2004 would cost about $380 billion. David Swanson with a working poor advocacy group called ACORN is furious that the temporary assistance for needy families money might be frozen.
We are talking about chump change here. We are talking about a few billion dollars when we are prepared to spend hundreds and hundreds of billion dollars on tax cuts for millionaires, not to mention a war that they refused to even say the price of.
Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
As we reported in the headlines, Turkish soldiers today fired in the air over the heads of demonstrators who tried to block what they call the illegal deployment of U.S. troops on Turkish soil. Meantime, the European Court for Human Rights censored Turkey for its treatment of Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan. From Diyarbakir, Aaron Glantz has the story.
The zilgit, the traditional call of Kurdish women. Hundreds of people turned out in front of the Diyarbakir office of DEHAP today. Members of the largest Kurdish political party in Turkey chanted slogans against the war on Iraq and the isolation of Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the illegal Kurdish militia, the PKK. Held since 1999 on his own island in the Mediterranean Ocean. For 15 weeks, he has been held in isolation. His lawyers and his family have been unable to see him.
This isolation is not legal. This isolation is against human rights, and we don't accept it. The government is against the laws, and that's why we're protesting.
Today, the European Court for Human Rights ruled Öcalan's isolation inhumane, but it also ruled his 1999 trial illegal by international standards because a military judge sat in during the courtroom proceedings. The court ordered a new trial and the payment of more than $100,000 to cover the Kurdish leader's court costs. This small businessman turned out at the demonstration. He wonders why the Turkish government is cracking down on Öcalan now, as the rebel leader renounced the armed struggle more than 3 years ago.
The isolation of Abdullah Öcalan had turned the positive atmosphere in Turkey into a negative one. The Turkish government is looking to military solutions rather than political ones. We are anxious about the upcoming period.
(Gülüyor)
The demonstration didn't last long. Only a few minutes after it started, a phalanx of riot police armed with M16 automatic rifles charged the crowd, which dispersed. An armed personnel carrier idled close by. Tens of thousands of Turkish army troops have entered southeastern Anatolia since George Bush started talking about war on Iraq a few months ago, and entire sections of the region are now part of a closed military zone. But despite the pressure, this 79-year-old grandmother says she will continue to turn out to protest.
Biz bunu kabul etmiyoruz. Her gün çarşamba günü biz bu eylemi yapacağız. Bir anne olarak en çok ezilen.
We don't accept this. We'll be here protesting every Wednesday. As a mother, we're the most oppressed and sorrowful. Young people die before seeing their mothers. We don't accept this. We'll keep protesting until we die.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Diyarbakir, southeastern Turkey.
Tonight's scheduled execution of Delma Banks in Huntsville, Texas, will mark the state's 300th execution. Concerns about Banks' wrongful conviction for a 1980 murder made the case unique because of the high numbers of claims his attorneys have raised about his original trial. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz has more.
Today, the Supreme Court debated charges of racially biased jury selection and incompetent attorney representation in the trial that sent Delma Banks to Texas death row. Justices also examined evidence that the state's witnesses gave false testimony during the penalty phase of Banks' trial. Neither Banks' defense attorney nor the jury were told the state's witnesses were paid informants. If the Supreme Court denies Banks' petition, his life rests in the hands of Texas Governor Rick Perry. Monday, the state's Board of Pardons and Paroles denied Banks' petition, which missed a filing deadline. One more reason, says Banks' attorney George Kendall, for Perry to stop tonight's execution.
We would hope, given the great concern about this case, that he uses his powers to grant a 30-day reprieve so that the board, if it wishes to seriously consider this, can do so.
Perry's decision comes after the Supreme Court's ruling that may be issued as late as 6 p.m. Central Time this evening, when Banks will be strapped to the gurney in Huntsville and prepared for his lethal injection. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz in Houston, Texas.
Meanwhile, for over 30 years, the victims' rights movement in the United States has struggled for services and legal rights for crime victims and their families. But a report released by Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation, a national anti-death penalty organization, indicates that all victims are not equal in the eyes of the legal system and victim service providers. Kelia Ramirez files this report.
Audrey and I were seen as bad victims because we were in opposition to what the state had in mind, which was an execution.
That was Gus Lamb, widower of Victoria Lamb, who was murdered in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1980 by a man named Randy Reeves. In 1999, Lamb and his 21-year-old daughter Audrey traveled from Oregon to Nebraska to speak at a hearing on the possible commutation of Reeves's death sentence. Gus Lamb, now a mental health therapist in Portland, described the discrimination he and his daughter faced.
During one of the hearings, the Attorney General read a letter from my sister-in-law stating her advocacy of the death penalty, and at the same time, even though Audrey and I had traveled over 1,000 miles to get there, they denied us the right to speak in opposition to that view.
The Nebraska Constitution provides for the right of murder victims' family members to make a written or oral statement at commutation proceedings. So the Lambs sued the Nebraska Board of Pardons. But the court ruled against them, with the judge stating that they were, quote, not victims as that term is commonly understood, unquote. Again, Gus Lamb.
The state saw us as being agents, I believe was the term they used, of Mr. Reeves.
Rennie Cushing, executive director of Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation and co-author of the report, Dignity Denied, The Experience of Murder Victims' Family Members Who Oppose the Death Penalty, says that his organization has found that death penalty states from Connecticut to California, Texas to Montana, discriminate against family members who oppose the death penalty. The report details instances in which family members were marginalized, silenced, or denied services to which they were legally entitled, such as information on the legal proceedings or advocacy and support during the trial. Some death penalty opponents, who nonetheless chose to witness the execution, were denied the debriefing and counseling required by state execution protocols. Cushing says the discrimination is rooted in a false assumption.
It's a presumption on the part of those who work with victims that all victims want the death penalty and that they need it for some kind of closure. And therefore, the whole policies for serving victims are arranged around that assumption.
Dr. Stephen Walker is a professor of criminology and victimology at California State University, Fresno, the first university in the United States to establish a victimology program. He says academia is sensitive to the issue.
We hit very hard in all of our classes the concept of second victimization, which is that the systems themselves harm the person a second time. And so, yes, we work very hard in teaching them not to do that, but individuals leave our program and others and work in the field, and they are bound by these policies and procedures of whatever agency they're in.
Part of the problem is that victim services programs are often run by prosecutors' offices. The report says, quote, when the prosecutor is seeking the death penalty, victims' family members who don't want the death penalty imposed are automatically in conflict with the prosecutor's agenda. It is too easy for such families to be relegated to the status of second-class victims. It is too easy for prosecutors to decide that such families are not really victims at all in the eyes of the law, and thus fail to grant them the rights and services that victims are supposed to receive, unquote. Cushing, whose father was murdered, hopes the report raises awareness.
We want to sensitize the victims' service community. We want to sensitize police, prosecutors, and the courts to those of us who've had someone murdered and who reject the execution solution to our pain.
Cushing says progress is being made. The Pennsylvania Department of Victims Services has made Dignity Denied required reading for all its victim services providers. A copy of the report, Dignity Denied, The Experience of Murder Victims' Family Members Who Opposed the Death Penalty, by Rennie Cushing and Susanna Scheffer, is available from the website of Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation at www.mvfr.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Homeland in hip-hop.
Free Speech Radio News commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from his cell on death row.
To think about the origins of hip-hop in this culture, and also about homeland security, is to see that there are, at the very least, two worlds in America. One of the well-to-do, and another of the struggling. For if ever there was the absence of homeland security, it is seen in the gritty roots of hip-hop. For the music arises from a generation that feels, with some justice, that they have been betrayed by those who came before them, that they are, at best, tolerated in schools, feared on the streets, and almost inevitably destined for the hellholes of prison. They grew up hungry, hated, and unloved. And this is the psychic fuel that generates the anger that seems endemic in much of the music and poetry. One senses very little hope above the personal goals of wealth to climb above the pit of poverty. In the broader society, the opposite is true. For here, more than any other place on earth, wealth is so widespread and so bountiful that what passes for the middle class in America could pass for the upper class in most of the rest of the world. Their very opulence and relative wealth makes them insecure, and homeland security is a governmental phrase that is as oxymoronic, as crazy as, say, military intelligence or the U.S. Department of Justice. They're just words that have very little relationship to reality. Now, do you feel safer now? Do you think you will anytime soon? Do you think duct tape and Kleenex and color codes will make you safer? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.